taking action on climate change. Here in Florida, it is cities and counties, not the state, who are leading the way. Good morning, and thanks for listening. This is First Coast Connect. I'm Melissa Ross. And just ahead, why local communities are way out in front here in Florida to adapt to our warming planet. You can get on the line now. What do you think the state should be doing to lead on climate? Give us a call, 549-2937. Then later, a look at Jacksonville's theater scene. It's growing. That's in our first art attack of 2019. Plus, a tourism win for our corner of Florida, with a record number of visitors reported to the First Coast over the last year. We'll tell you about it. All of that ahead this morning. But first this hour, Jacksonville saw a high of 83 degrees on January 1st. The city's hottest New Year's Day on record. Did you notice it? Man, some unusually warm winter weather out there. And if it's got you thinking about the incremental effects of climate change, you're not alone. Activists around the world and across this country are growing increasingly urgent and forceful about the need to take bold steps to reduce carbon emissions, to fight the dangerous effects of a warming planet. Now, here's what's happening in Florida. We have not had strong leadership in Tallahassee on this issue, so local leaders around the state are stepping up, investing in clean energy solutions to protect their communities. We're going to begin the hour here on First Coast Connect this morning with a closer look at cities and counties in Florida leading the way on climate, as we welcome Chris Castro. He's director of the Office of Sustainability and Resilience for the City of Orlando. Hey, Chris, good morning. Good morning, Chris. Good to have you on the show. Also on the line, Susan Glickman. She is the Florida Director for the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy. Hey, Susan, good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
And here's our question to callers. Living here in Florida, how concerned are you about climate change, rising sea levels, the impacts to our infrastructure and our way of life here in the Sunshine State? What would you like city leaders here in North Florida to do to get serious about climate? We want you to give us a call right now, 549-2937 to join us. That's 549-2937. Or go online, send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org, tweets to @MelissaInJax, or let us know your thoughts on our Facebook page. Now, in a moment, we'll talk with you, Chris, to find out what's happening at the City of Orlando to deal with the effects of climate change. But first, Susan, I'd like you to kind of set the table for us statewide. You are the Florida Director for the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy, so you kind of have a big picture view of what's happening on this issue around Florida. Where is the state leading and where is it lagging behind when it comes to addressing this issue of getting ready to deal with sea level rise and all the other related effects of climate?
Yes, thank you for that. And for some context, really there is an absence of leadership at the federal level. We do need, when you talk about climate change, we do need world cooperation, world agreement to limit these dangerous carbon pollutions overall. Florida is a very big state, so we're a huge user of energy, so we have a responsibility to lead. So even in the George W. Bush administration, the same sort of narrative took place, where when the federal government wouldn't take action, states and local governments were leading. And so here we are again, and having that same conversation where the Trump administration says they intend to pull out of the Paris Agreement. There just was the 24th Conference of the Parties took place in Poland, and even former Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger was there saying, you know, don't forget that local governments, some states, but not the state of Florida, but local governments like the City of Orlando are leading. In the Tampa Bay region, 27 local governments have just come together to form the Tampa Bay Regional Resiliency Coalition, and the South Florida Climate Compact has been in place for 10 years now, and they do a tremendous amount of work around climate vulnerability assessments, and they create shared sea level rise projections. They do more work in the arena of what we call adaptation, which is adapting to the climate impacts that are just already baked into the pipeline, even if we turn the CO2 spigot off tomorrow. But a lot of us, in particular, the city of Orlando is a great example of folks that are also working on reducing greenhouse gas emissions so we don't make it worse. And what that means is, as a practical matter, coastal communities might be sort of in the pipeline for 2 feet of sea level rise. 2 to 3 feet is what has been projected by the Tampa Bay Science Advisory Panel. Those are similar projections to what they're using in South Florida. But let's not make it 3 feet or 4 feet or 5 feet. Let's not make it worse. So we need to be prepared for extreme weather, you know, emergencies that are going to be exacerbated by climate change. We need to adapt to the impacts already in the pipeline. That might mean, you know, sea level rise ordinances and, you know, other things, returning certain areas back to natural shorelines. And then we need to drastically reduce our energy use and move to solar and make our buildings more efficient so that we don't make the problems worse.
So many things have to happen in a short period of time, as you just pointed out, to meaningfully address this crisis. It's 549-2937. Give us a call as we talk about how cities and counties, not the state, are leading the way on climate. Chris Castro, you
and
head
Melissa?
Up the just a second. Chris Castro, you head up the Office of Sustainability and Resilience for the City of Orlando. Tell us what's happening in Central Florida on this issue.
Well, you know, for a long time, the City of Orlando has, you know, been out ahead of this conversation. Thanks to Orlando Mayor Buddy Dyer, we've over the last 10 years. Established a pretty robust program called GreenWorks Orlando. And the whole effort has been to look at this climate crisis as a means of economic development. We see that in order for us to be a force in the 21st century, that cities really need to begin to look at ways in which we can mitigate and adapt to climate change, and we could create healthier, cleaner, and more sustainable cities. And so over the last 10 years, we've really been looking at the climate crisis specifically under the guise of kind of three main objectives. One is, how do we drive energy efficiency in the built environment and lower the amount of energy use? Susan mentioned that buildings are a major contributor. And in fact, when we did our greenhouse gas emissions inventory, we found that buildings were about 3/4 of all of the emissions that are associated with Orlando. So first and foremost, driving building efficiency is critical. We became the first city in Florida to pass a building benchmarking and transparency policy, which basically requires the largest buildings to disclose of their energy use and the cost of utilities in their buildings every year, making the market more informed. We also have a very important energy financing programs. One of them is called PACE, Property Assessed Clean Energy. The other one is called SELF, the Solar and Energy Loan Fund. These are essentially our financial tools that allows homeowners and business owners to make investments in their facilities to lower their energy use and to make them more efficient. So reducing the energy in our buildings contributes directly towards reducing the emissions coming out of the smokestack.
Okay.
Secondly, we realize that renewable energy is obviously a critical strategy, so shifting the fuel sources towards cleaner. And then lastly, the transportation sector. How do we electrify our buses, our fleets, and our vehicles to ensure that these vehicles are cleaner, healthier, and again, more sustainable?
A multi-pronged effort. Now, as we've been hearing Susan Glickman, in Tampa, there's a regional climate compact. In Orlando, Chris just explained an aggressive effort that's been going on for years. Southeast Florida has had a regional climate compact for a decade. The other big major city in Florida, Jacksonville, not at that level, at least not yet. Now, here's what we do know. The city of Jacksonville, by law, has to create a citizens committee to study Jacksonville's flooding risks. They have to do that this year. Climate, though, is not in the agenda for this. At the same time, we're hearing that there's momentum in Jacksonville to create a new energy and resilience commission that would formulate, you know, a 20-year plan for climate mitigation and adaptation. This is being discussed. It hasn't been implemented yet. So let me ask you, Susan, how far behind is our North Florida when it comes to getting serious about this? It seems to me, just listening to both of you talk, that Jacksonville has a long way to go to catch up to the other major metros in Florida on this issue.
Well, and also the East Central Florida Regional Planning Council, of which Orlando, Orange County, Brevard, Volusia, has already passed a resolution to form their own resiliency coalition in the first steering committee, and Chris and I were both there together, met. So there has been some efforts, particularly post-Hurricane Matthew, and I know that St. Augustine felt the sting of that, and with the low-lying areas and historic, you know, just interest that you have in St. Augustine. I know there has been some attention paid to that, and your regional planning council was having conversations, you know, for some time. But I think that you're right that Jacksonville area has not yet taken kind of a formal initiative, but it does take leadership. In Tampa Bay, it's Pinellas County Commissioner Janet Long. She initiated the Resiliency Coalition at the Regional Planning Council, and now it has form. I mean, you need leaders to take action. And even 10 years ago, you know, now State Representative Kristen Jacobs, you know, essentially took the lead with other county commissioners. She was a Broward commissioner at the time. So that's really what we need in Jacksonville. So what you're saying, Melissa, you know, actually sounds good to me that they're going to put together a committee to look at resilience. I mean, in the area, you have so many issues with the coastline, and you have ports and real estate and so much at stake there. And if we get out in front of these problems, you know, we can plan and we can meet the challenge. But most importantly, we have got to reduce these emissions so that we can avoid the worst implications of climate change. And, you know, we can meet the agreement, even if, you know, the Trump administration wants to pull out the Paris Agreement. It doesn't mean that we, you know, as local communities can't meet those reduction goals because of work like Mayor Buddy Dyer and what Chris Castor is talking about in Orlando. We have the technology to make our buildings more efficient and to electrify transportation. So it's so important that we move. The sooner, the better. It will cost us less, and, you know, more people, less people will get hurt in the process.
It's 549-2937 to join the show as we talk climate action. Going to your calls in just a moment. Lots of tweets, emails, Facebook comments on this too. Here's a tweet from Jim. The state could do more to encourage rooftop solar by pressuring utilities to improve their net metering rates for property owners. We'll talk about that. Here's a tweet from Josh. Newly elected Governor Ron DeSantis has a surprisingly progressive environmental platform. It includes banning offshore drilling and smart growth along coastal cities. Chris Castro, your thoughts about how Governor DeSantis will deal with this issue and whether he'll depart somewhat from former governor, now Senator Rick Scott, who, you know, infamously had an administration that, according to published reports, would not even allow his employees to use the words climate change.
Correct. I mean, truthfully, I'm not fully up to speed with DeSantis's platform, and I will say that we are hopeful, and we're staying hopeful and optimistic about the opportunity for City of Orlando and other local governments to collaborate more meaningfully on this issue with Tallahassee and our governor. I do think that this is an incredible opportunity here for economic development for the state. We spend about $60 billion per year in powering the state of Florida. Most of that money, if not all of it, leaves our state and goes towards fueling the coal mines, fueling the fracking wells in order for us to meet our fuel needs. And so we see in Orlando the opportunity of us being a leader in the clean energy economy and being able to keep that money here locally, hiring people to put solar on rooftops, hiring people to make our buildings more energy efficient and keep those revenues here in the local community. And we feel that that is a major economic development strategy for the state of Florida. And hopefully our governor and his administration also realizes the economic development opportunities that we face as we work to mitigate and adapt to a changing climate.
We're having a little issue getting our phone lines going. Keep calling people, 549-2937, and we will get you connected. We're getting emails, phone calls, lots of tweets. You know, this is such a hot topic, Susan. Increasingly, there is bipartisan support for taking more aggressive action on climate change, particularly in the wake of that most recent climate assessment that just came out a few weeks ago. And it broke down, Susan, how different regions of the country will be expected to be impacted by this. You, whether you live in the Northeast, the Midwest, the South, you could look and see exactly what we can expect when we go into the next couple of decades. Can you paint a picture for us what we can expect here in Florida, the worst case and the best case scenarios as we continue to face the impacts of rising seas and a warming planet and all the related effects that go along with that, whether it's more severe storms, more flooding, risks to our infrastructure, which often people don't think about, and a lot more?
The essence of the most recent National Climate Assessment, which was actually released on Black Friday when lots of people were probably shopping, was that the impacts of climate are here. It's not necessarily something which often people think about in the distant future. It's happening right now, and communities are dealing with it and paying for the cost of it. And the key takeaway is that the cost of inaction is greater than the cost of action. So, for instance, in Miami Beach, they're spending $600 million on pumps and raising roads. The city of Miami just passed a $400 million bond deal, but almost $200 million of it is going to climate impacts. So you have to raise your bridges and you know, your roads and whatever you need to do to kind of keep your communities sort of high and dry. So depending upon, and this is where the rubber meets the road, depending upon how well we do at dramatically reducing our greenhouse gas emissions with the kinds of efforts that Chris just talked about, becoming more efficient, solar and the electrification of transportation is going to indicate, are you dealing with 2 feet of sea level rise by mid-century, or are you dealing, you know, with four? And, you know, it's a huge difference. There are huge financial impacts. There's a whole other arena, and we talk about the economics. So if you have the economic opportunity to create, economic development, on the converse, we could also be hurt economically, for instance, with public health implications. So right now, and you were speaking about we've had a good year in tourism in Florida. Right now, we have 25 days a year where the heat and humidity index is 105 degrees or greater. And by mid-century, it's predicted, and 13 out of the top 15 cities are in Florida, that we'll have 100 days. We call them danger days. So we'll have 100 days a year where the heat and humidity index is 105 degrees. So what does that do to our tourism and economy? You know, as many people may not want to come to our beautiful beaches or to Disney World or up to see St. Augustine because it's so hot out. I'm a native Floridian, and we know how taxing that heat can be. So that's just one example of sort of the negative potential, you know, terrible impacts that we could be feeling. And then that's going to hurt our economy at a time where we're going to be called on to spend more money, to do barriers or build things or relocate some communities that are just in dangerously low areas. So, you know, we could get a grip on this and move quickly, or we could really get, you know, womped up both sides of our head at the same time.
Right. And whether people are dialed into the environmental science behind this, the dollars and cents, I think, are right, forcing a reckoning. You know, a study that came out a few months ago finds that Florida stands to lose more homes and real estate value to the damage from sea level rise than any other state in the nation. By the year 2045, nearly 64,000 homes in Florida will face flooding every other week. So half of those are in South Florida, but some of them are up here too. So let's go to your calls as we talk about how cities and counties are leading the way on climate action in Florida, the state most at risk for climate change effects. It's 549-2937. Tom is in Atlantic Beach. Hi, Tom. Good morning. Go ahead.
Hi. Hi, good morning. Just wanted to speak. Both your guests are really well informed in terms of Chris with the to-dos of things we need to do, and then your other guests in terms of the economic cost of inaction and economic benefit of action. So I think that's easy to implement those things if we just get to work here in Jacksonville. Bigger issues locally is just failure of strategic leadership coming primarily from the mayor's office and to a lesser extent city council. So in terms of things that we need to do in Northeast Florida, that would be it, a change in leadership, ASAP to deal with these things. And then on a more tactical level, since JA is a citizen-owned utility, can we compel them to switch to natural gas and solar at a more rapid rate as opposed to continuing to burn coal? And then also, lastly, would be all these things cost money. And so with our tax structure here in Jacksonville, I don't see how we implement a lot of these things under the current system. I mean, you can't. We have investments that need to be made. You can't go to Wall Street with no money and expect a return on your investment. You can't invest in these things that we need and expect a return if we don't have anything to invest with.
Okay, Tom. Yeah, lots of great points, Tom. So, Chris Castro, you head up the Office of Sustainability and Resilience for the City of Orlando. Jacksonville, of course, turned down money from the Rockefeller Foundation to create a similar office here in our city. Actually turned that money down. So what about Tom's comments?
Yeah, I mean, I think Tom's right that leadership is absolutely critical, both at every level of government. And it's important that whenever there is an election, that we hold our potential candidates and elected officials accountable. Climate change needs to be at the table in terms of a conversation in every election moving forward. And I think that you'll see more and more that people are interested in what our local governments want to do to protect ourselves. In this national climate assessment that was mentioned, the impact on our communities and our health and well-being were some of the highest priorities that were outlined within this plan. And we continue to talk about climate change in this economic lens and what's going to happen to our infrastructure. But I think in order for us to strike at the core of people and activate people to do something, we need to change the conversation about climate change and how this issue is impacting our health and our well-being, our air quality, the transmission of diseases, climate-related events that are going to impact our communities. These are things that are more important and more relevant for people on a day-to-day basis. And so I do think that leadership is critical. The second major point I think was mentioned around utilities is also very interesting. Right now in the state of Florida, we almost have a utility renewable energy arms race where the large investor owns like FPL and Duke Energy, as well as the municipal utilities like OUC, are beginning to dramatically increase renewable energy generation in their portfolio. And they're doing it not because they're altruism and want to be environmentally friendly. They're doing it because it's the least cost option for us to produce power moving forward. We've hit a tipping point with the economics of renewable energy that it is now cheaper. Renewables plus storage is now cheaper than even putting up a new peak or natural gas plant, or definitely coal or nuclear generation. And so OUC, as an example, recently earlier this year in May of 2018, signed a major deal with 14 other municipal utilities across the state of Florida to procure 223.5 megawatts of solar, of which Orlando is going to be taking 108 megawatts of solar for our generation. This will move us nearly to 10% of our entire portfolio coming from solar energy, and at the same time saving us money because it the price point came in at cheaper than what we can produce power from legacy technologies.
Okay.
This is a major tipping point that we're
seeing. That is a tipping point.
And so I do think that utilities are moving, starting to see the writing on the wall and moving in the right direction.
Moving in that direction. Lots of comments meanwhile on our First Coast Connect Facebook page. Nilofar writes, I'm freaking out. We need to educate people to make better decisions, reduce water waste, use less hot water, waste less food, reduce, reuse, recycle, carpool, or drive a fuel-efficient vehicle. Go solar. Lots of good advice. And here's a comment from Susan. Please mention an upcoming event looking at the impacts of severe weather on Northeast Florida coastal communities. This is coming up on January 15th at 6 p.m. at the JU Marine Science Research Institute as the St. John's River Keeper and the Southeast Coastal Ocean Observing Regional Association host a free public forum on the effects of understanding hurricanes and sea level rise. Thanks for that. And let's go to a few more calls. Mark is in St. Augustine right now. Hi, Mark. Thanks for holding. Good morning. What are your thoughts?
Hey, good morning. I I appreciate the topic today, but I guess I need to preface this. I'm not a global warming skeptic. I'm a man-made global warming skeptic. So I say that only because in all the discussions you've had, you've talked about how we need to reduce and become more efficient and renewable and all that. And I'm not opposed to any of that. So recently there was in the IPCC report that came out, I think it was on September or so last year, they even made a comment in there that supposed increases in hurricanes and these natural disasters are not attributed to climate change, to man-made climate change. So you do have some studies out there that say the things that you're seeing aren't as a result of man-made climate change. So go back to...
I think it's more complicated than saying, Mark, that every severe storm or weather event is related to climate change. But that said, I think that we need to have Susan respond to that because... the science is in. The climate is warming and human behavior is primarily the cause. We're not going to entertain climate denialism on this program. However, I appreciate your point, and I want to get Susan to address it. Susan Glickman, go ahead.
Yeah,
go ahead, Susan.
Melissa, can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead.
Great. It's really in the scientific community, there's not one single published peer review document that indicates anything other than increasing human activity, which is obviously building up greenhouse gas emissions. I'll give you just one example. The Trump administration has already made moves to roll back fuel efficiency standards for cars that were underway. And they admitted through the National Highway Transportation Safety analysis that just that one policy change will drive our emissions to 781 parts per million of carbon in the atmosphere. So when you measure parts per million of carbon in the atmosphere with ice core samples, it's kind of like your height or your weight. You know, it's just a measurement. You might not like it, but it is what it is. So we are past 400 now. So about a million years, we were 290 parts per million of carbon in the atmosphere. We're past 400, and business as usual was going to take us up into the 600.
Okay, but let me just jump in, Susan. I want to ask you quickly. I want to ask you quickly about that caller's comment that even in the most recent climate assessment, he saw data that showed that you can't attribute every severe weather event to the effects of climate change. I think that was the question he had. So what about that?
Yeah, I'm totally unfamiliar with what he's referring, but it is true that every single weather event, but increasingly we see these, more intense storms. The algae bloom is a good example. Warmer, wetter weather, makes the algae blooms more toxic. It kills more organisms that create more nutrient pollution. So it's the same thing. If the warmer Gulf of Mexico, is warmer as it is, even in 2005 with Hurricane Wilma, the hurricane went from a 1 to 3. Warmer water is going to create, more intense storms. That's just a fact. So anyway, I'm not sure what that gentleman is referring to. The National Climate Assessment was unequivocal in its assessment. I mean, the science has just gotten sort of tougher and tougher. I've been working on this issue for almost 20 years. So, from that perspective, there's no one in the scientific community.
Susan, let me get a few more callers on the line. Lots of people wanting to connect with you and Chris, who's down in Orlando. Sarah is in Atlantic Beach right now. Hey, Sarah, good morning to you.
Good morning. Can you hear me?
Yeah, go ahead.
Great. Thank you for taking my call. I want to do a shout out to both Chris and Susan. They do fabulous work in this arena. And I wanted to add on to the to-do kind of list of what we can do locally. First is measurement. City of Atlantic Beach is participating in a LEED for Cities certification. It's hoping to be the first city in Florida to achieve that certification. Cities like St. Augustine has also done a vulnerability assessment. So cities can start doing that. There is also still on the books an executive order that Mayor Payton put on asking for a sustainability officer. So that has not been redacted. So that's something we could do quickly. And then to the man-made comment, there was this great quote in a fabulous film called Climate Refugees. And he said, the cameraman behind the camera said, I hope it's man-made, because then we can fix it.
Thanks, Sarah. Right? Yeah, so, yeah. Thank you for all of those comments. Let me mention quickly getting emails about other events. There is the 3rd annual Keeping History Above Water Conference. That's coming up in St. Augustine, May 5th through 8th, with significant nationally and internationally renowned speakers. Also, on January 7th, someone on our Facebook page is letting us know that the Jacksonville Waterways Commission is meeting and discussing some of these issues. Okay, so all of that said, Chris Castro, let's close with you. Your final thoughts.
Well, you know, I think what was just mentioned by Sarah is brilliant. There's a covenant called the Global Covenant of Mayors for Climate and Energy. And I really encourage everyone who's listening in here to reach out to your mayors and your elected officials to see if they'd be interested in joining. This was a covenant that came together following the Paris Climate Agreement in COP21 and essentially helped local governments have a voice in this conversation. As we're seeing with the Trump administration, there's threats to pull us out of this important agreement. And local governments like Mayor Dyer and others helped to create a wave across the country, the climate mayors, what they're known as, who are doubling down on our commitments. I think it's absolutely imperative, again, that the conversation really focuses on how climate change impacts us, impacts our health, our well-being, our long-term opportunities for economic development and job creation. And if we put climate change in that lens, I think we're going to start to see people really prioritize this issue and be able to grapple with it. Oftentimes, climate change is looked at as this insurmountable problem that can't be addressed by any one individual. I personally believe that each one of us has an opportunity, and every decision that we make has an impact either positively or negatively on the planet and on our local communities.
Everyone can take action. That's right. So thank you so much for both of you joining us with your insights on this. Two leaders here in Florida. Susan Glickman, she's the Florida director with the Southern Alliance for Clean Energy. Chris Castro, he's director of the Office of Sustainability and Resilience for the City of Orlando. Chris, Susan, thanks for being on the show.
Thank you, Melissa.
Thanks for having us, Melissa.
Thank you so much. And much more still ahead. Don't go away. Later, we talked about tourism a few minutes ago. Guess what? The numbers are up for First Coast tourism. We'll explore why. And up next, it's our art attack and the growth of our local theater scene. Things are popping out all over. We'll be right back. Don't go away. Well, Jacksonville has a thriving local theater scene, and this year it is poised to be bigger and bolder than ever. Why is theater growing so fast here on the First Coast? We're talking about it right now in our Art Attack, our monthly look at arts and culture trends around town. As we welcome Lee Hamby, Managing Director of the Five and Dime Theater. Good morning.
Good morning.
Suzanne Hudson-Smith, she's Executive Director of Players by the Sea.
Good morning.
Local actor, director, writer, and composer Jason Woods.
Good morning.
And freelance director and theater arts marketing professional Bradley Akers. Good morning.
Morning.
All right, let's start with you, Lee. There are more than a dozen theaters around town. But for some reason lately, the local theater scene has really evolved. What's driving that?
Gosh, there's so many things to say about that. In my lifetime, being from Jacksonville, to see the difference that has occurred in theater is amazing. And I think that, what is the main reason? I don't know what the main reason would be. I think it's just an art form that really we're able to tell true to life stories and take people on this journey. And it's for me, it's that instant gratification. You know, a lot of people are interested in film and it's that hurry up and wait thing. Theater is that instant gratification. You get on stage, you have one chance to do it and you do it. And it's like a drug. I call it my drug of choice.
Yeah. There's nothing like the energy of a live performance. I mean, there's a reason why Broadway is a huge driver of tourism in New York. For example, Suzanne Hudson Smith, Players by the Sea. Your theater is known for mounting increasingly cutting-edge productions. And tell me a little bit about how you see this whole sector evolving.
Well, I think it's about the talent that's here. I mean, there is so much talent that needs an outlet, as Lee had said. I mean, we all thrive on being that. But for us, it's helped us. You know, we have two stages at Players by the Sea. So there's a main stage and there's a studio stage, and it affords us an opportunity to do some really great larger pieces that are musicals. Bridges of Madison County is coming up, so that's going to be a great opportunity
to see that. And that's opening this month.
January 25th. Wonderful talent in that, and some performers in that who haven't been seen in the Jacksonville area at all before. And we've got that studio, so we can do some cutting edge plays in there, and we can also provide people musicals. But the talent here is amazing.
Yeah, we should make a little plug for WJCT Studios, the Phase 8 Theater Company. Yes. Does shows.
Absolutely.
Right here in our studios, which is so excellent.
Yeah.
Now, Jason Woods, you are such a talented actor and director and writer. Lots of people have seen you on stage performing your one-man show, A Christmas Carol, but that's just one small part of the work you do. There is a lot of talent here. Is the infrastructure finally coming around to support all this local talent, or are there still a lot of obstacles to growing this piece of our culture in Jacksonville?
It's a great question. I think there are always obstacles, but there is a unanimity, I think, amongst the leadership in theater. But I think maybe in a broader scope, much broader, we've been so married to our phones for so long. And I think people are really craving engagement one-on-one. And theater, I think, is the best model for that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. There's engagement with diversity, the opportunity to put ego aside and try to build a product that everyone's proud of, and a moment that you really, really, truly can't replicate once it's done.
Yeah. But technology, younger audiences, Bradley, they're sort of impacting the way we consume and experience theater in Northeast Florida as well.
They are. They want to get engaged with something that they've always come up knowing. You know, their parents or their grandparents saw theater. And so we're seeing this kind of cyclical nature. Our members are becoming younger. They're engaging with our technology. And I think that that then goes to our young talent, too, who feel empowered. And you know, I, as a young theater artist coming up in the Jacksonville theater scene, just always felt empowered to either see a show or actually get up on stage, get behind the scenes. And I think that that's really remarkable.
Now, as I mentioned, New York's Broadway is renowned. I used to live in Chicago. Steppenwolf Theater, Looking Glass Theater. They are huge cultural institutions there, and they drive tourism. Lee Hamby, would you like to see Jacksonville become known for this piece of our arts and culture scene, the local theater, the local acting and directing and producing talent that we have here, because we have a really big community of talent.
We do, and that's exactly why I'm here or back here, and that's what I talk about a lot. And actually, our last Art Attack was about how do we keep the young artists here, and it is my drive to see artists paid for what they do, especially theater artists. Because I'd like for those people to stay here and for us to become a town that is known for theater. And we definitely could have that happen. The talent here is amazing. We were talking about that in the green room. If we could get the people to stay here and we could really become sustainable, we have the potential. We have the size of town that we need. It's a place that people want to be. People always come back here. So they leave to go experience other things and learn other things. And then they come back here, and we're lucky to have them because they want to raise a family or whatever.
And there are so many great local playhouses and theaters. You have your pick of places to go and see live theater. I mentioned Phase 8. There's, of course, the Times Union Center, which brings the artist series through with Broadway shows. There's Players by the Sea. There's the Five and Dime. Mm-hmm. There's Theater Jacksonville, which is the oldest community theater in the state of Florida. There's the Apex Theater, the Limelight Theater.
There's ABET.
I'm forgetting a few.
And in surrounding areas, like in Fernandina, there's Amelia Community Theater, there's Amelia Musical Playhouse. There's now Island Theater there in Fernandina. In Fleming Island. There's just so much going on, and it's exciting. And we all kind of fill a niche. It's cool.
Suzanne.
And there's... What I noticed was there's a lot going on everywhere, but there can be more. I mean, we look at our space and we see our studio theater not being used at certain points. And we just opened it up by a casual comment to Fletcher High School to say, hey, you guys are young. If you've got a project, bring it in. And they jumped on it and they're coming in, but we're helping mentor them through the process of management, producing, directing, and acting. And I think that helps, hopefully, keep them engaged here in Jacksonville and stay here in Jacksonville, knowing they have these kind of opportunities where they can go in and make something happen.
You know, Jason Woods, I think you're an example of that. You're an actor and producer who has the talent to work just about anywhere, but you've chosen to stay here. Why?
I came here about 10 years ago and hibernated actually from theater in another job. And the loss of that job made me start to branch out and connect with people slowly. And then you develop relationships. And I think I value relationships and character and integrity with people almost equally with talent. So the relationships that are here, they're wonderful, not only talented people here, but wonderful people here. Uh-huh. And I think it's a deserving place for that kind of growth. It's been a long time coming. Lee has enough sweat equity for a dozen people with all that he's done. Yeah. And I think a big reward is due Jacksonville in this regard. And I think everybody's right. It's coming.
You know, Bradley, when you talk to the Cultural Council of Greater Jacksonville, they will tell you that every dollar invested in art and culture in this city gets a huge return. So whether it's art, live music, live theater, it's a good investment. There's an economic return that you get from having a lively cultural scene, and that includes theater.
You do. There's a reason it's community theater. It's by the community and for the community. You know, our local playhouses are mostly community theater, which means anybody can get involved. So it's quite remarkable to see someone, you know, maybe your bagger at Publix is in a show and he's killing it. So it's just an amazing community experience to look at someone and go, hey, we're living in Jacksonville and we're creating for the people of Jacksonville. How exciting.
Mm-hmm. As you said, Lee, the next step is to actually get people paid for their work, because by and large, people do this as a labor of love. Now, with all of that said, what shows are coming up in the first quarter of 2019 people need to keep their eye out for, including your show, Suzanne, at Players by the Sea, The Bridges of Madison County? People might remember the book and the movie. It's also now a live show.
It is, and I think that's a great one. When you talk about the combination of trying to get people paid, actors paid, this show is sponsored by the Stage Fund, and that is their mission, is to make sure performers stay here, artists stay here, and whether they're technical or they're on the stage, that they are rewarded for that. And this is a perfect combination. Lee and I loved each other since we met each other when I came into town, and this show, being co-director with him, has really brought a lot of people together. It's, if you'll pardon the pun, built a bridge. On a lot of different
places. Bridge. Okay. Well, thank you, Jason. What else is on the calendar this year?
Well, I think ABET is doing Robert Bridegroom, directed by Bradley Akers.
Very good.
Yes. I'm not supposed to announce this yet, but I'm going to.
Do it.
The energy's just right. I'm doing a fundraiser with Theater Jacksonville. 3 years ago, I staged Peter Pan. We're going to do a staged reading of it with the local talent here. We're going to have a ball with it, and our own Lee Hamby will have a major role in it this time.
Very nice. Well, kudos to all of you, and break a leg, as they say, with all of your shows. Thanks for all you do. Lee Hamby with the Five and Dimes, Suzanne Hudson-Smith, Players by the Sea, actor and director Jason Woods, and freelance director Bradley Akers, all big contributors to the local theater scene. Thanks for being on the show.
Thank you for having us.
You're welcome.
And in a moment, why tourism is growing so fast here in Jacksonville with record numbers of visitors last year. Yes, Jacksonville has been discovered. We will take a closer look why in just a moment. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Keep listening.
After just one bite.
You're in trouble now.
Cool paradise, I turn high.
Abortion legislation is expected to be a key issue at the state level this year.
States that are hostile to reproductive rights are going to be jockeying to be the state that sends a law to the Supreme Court.
With a conservative-leaning court, activists say the stakes are high for both sides. That story this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today at 4 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
I'm Marco Werman. The World's Newsroom brings you the big picture stories and some other stuff.
The whole of Niagara Falls is ripping over my right shoulder. As an ice climber, it's the largest, wildest thing I could think of climbing, and it's never been climbed. So I'm really happy to have had the opportunity to go and stick an ice tool into it.
Join us and hear the world this afternoon at 3 on 89.9 WJCT.
On the next Fresh Air, Adam McKay talks about directing the new film Vice about Dick Cheney, perhaps the most powerful vice president in American history. It's nominated for 6 Golden Globes and stars Christian Bale as Cheney. Vice combines investigative journalism, speculation, and comedy. McKay also made The Big Short and Anchorman. Join us today at noon on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
12 years ago, Nancy Pelosi made history.
To the first woman speaker in our history, the gentlelady from California, Nancy Pelosi.
She's gone head-to-head with President Trump.
Please don't characterize the strength that I bring to this meeting.
Now she'll be sworn in as speaker again as Democrats retake the House. That story this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today at 4 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
Welcome back. Well, finally this hour, good news for both Florida and our First Coast. In 2018, it turns out that not only the state, but our Northeast corner enjoyed another year of record-breaking tourism numbers. Yeah, the First Coast is killing it when it comes to vacationers choosing this part of the state to hang out. How is the First Coast being marketed to the world? Why are more people choosing to vacation here? We've got some answers right now from Michael Corrigan. He's the president of Visit Jacksonville. Hey, Michael.
Hey, Melissa. It's great to be here.
And congratulations. The record-breaking tourist visits in 2018. You're still collecting some figures, but what are you showing when it comes to tourism numbers?
Well, Melissa, we're very excited to be reporting a 1.9% increase so far over 9 months of the year in tourism in Jacksonville. And that's a continued growth that we've been experiencing for quite a period now. But we're excited that it's still continuing.
Right. And not only is Duval seeing this, so are St. John's and Nassau counties enjoying just incredible numbers. Now, tell me a little bit about marketing. I know you're really marketing to cities that have direct flights to Jacksonville. Smart move. But you're also really changing the way you market on social media. How are you doing that?
Yeah, Melissa, we've started doing something that's really interesting and paying off huge dividends for us. We believe we are now using social media influencers in much of our marketing. That's where we bring somebody into town and let them experience Jacksonville and see all it has to offer. And they go back and either they write about it or do short videos on it or anything else. And as you and I both know, once you come and visit Jacksonville, you start to fall in love with it. And writing about it and coming back and experiencing it again becomes quite easy. And we're seeing that in these individuals that are coming to town.
Sure. People with hundreds of thousands of followers on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, you get them to experience it. Then they spread the good news. And so for so many years, when people in the Northeast or other parts of the country thought of Florida, they think of either Disney or Miami. It's your goal to get them, I guess, to think more about Jacksonville and the beaches.
Exactly. We all know, those of us that live here know that Jacksonville is the premier city in the state of Florida. And with all the water activities we have and all the cultural activities that we have, ecotourism, there's so much to offer. And really all we have to do is make sure that people know that we're here and invite them to come visit us.
Okay. And so what are some of the challenges to continuing to get this message out? You've had so much success, but The tourism marketing business is competitive. You're competing with lots of other cities. How do you go about the competition aspect of this?
We really just have to sell our assets. We really don't have to recreate the wheel at this point. We've been, for a number of years, a unique visiting location. And if we can get you to think about coming to Florida without thinking about Disney or Miami Beach, then Jacksonville becomes a natural place for people to come. And we think that through the social media and various different aspects that we're doing, we're starting to do that better and better.
Now, the new tagline that you're using to market Jacksonville is Jax, it's easier here. Mm-hmm. How is that playing around the country?
That is playing phenomenally around the country. It's not very well liked in Jacksonville.
And people always dump on whatever the slogan is. Yeah, sure.
But if you're in Jacksonville, we've already succeeded in getting you here. So we're really reaching out. And Jax, it's easier here is working very well around the country. And if you visualize your visit to Jacksonville and your first 15 minutes of arriving at our airport, you realize it really is much easier here than it is anywhere else. And visitors are sold on that. And when they get here, they believe it.
It is true that if you come through the South Florida airport or you come through Orlando's airport and then you experience coming in and taking off from our airport, it's a completely different experience. And I can certainly attest to that. It is easier to travel here. Let me ask you one more question. At the top of the hour, we talked about how cities and counties are trying to lead on the impact of climate change in Florida and fears that eventually a hotter and hotter state with threatened real estate values could negatively impact our tourism economy. Does Visit Jacksonville follow that? And what's the long-term strategy, do you think, not just for Visit Jacksonville, but Visit Florida and just the tourism business in general, to keep that sector of the economy strong as we deal with that issue?
Sure. Visit Jacksonville and Visit Florida, we both monitor everything. Anything that happens in the state of Florida is monitored and tracked closely. And we believe that long-term there could be an effect. But right now, as we talk to visitors that come here and survey them as they leave and give us input back, that is not a topic that's at the top of the list at this point. Obviously, traffic and other things of such of that nature are much higher on the radar screen. But everything that happens in Jacksonville, which is where we stay focused, everything that happens either positively or negatively, we monitor and we make changes where mm-hmm. we think is necessary to address it.
Okay, so another year of record-breaking tourist visits in 2018. What's your goal for 2019? To break yet a new record?
Break a new record, Melissa. We hope that our innovation continues to make Jacksonville more attractive to visitors around the country.
All right. He is Michael Corrigan, the president of Visit Jacksonville, marketing Jacksonville, and along with the tourism bureaus in Duval and or rather Nassau and St. John's counties, marketing the region to the entire world. So kudos on that success, and come visit us again sometime soon.
Thanks, Melissa.
Thanks for being here. Well, that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Michelle Corum is our director. And if you miss something or you have feedback for us, we always want to hear from you. Send emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And if you missed anything this morning, catch our rebroadcast of First Coast Connect tonight at 8 p.m. right here on 89.9. I'm Melissa Ross. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.